Good morning. It's 8:06. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. I'm Michelle Deininger, filling in for Leslie Thatcher. On the phone with us right now, we have meteorologist Thomas Gaboy. Good morning, Thomas. What's happening weather-wise?
Well, and good morning. I hope that you had a good weekend. As we're moving into this week, we're going to be settling into a stretch of some pretty nice weather. So for today, we're starting off with a good amount of cloud coverage, but that's because the moisture that we had over this past weekend is now in the process of moving away. So other than a small chance for an isolated shower, and that's mainly going to be east of Park City, we're going to be looking at a mostly dry sky today as our sky becomes increasingly sunny with the daytime high climbing to around 75 degrees. So it's a little cool outside right now, but by this afternoon, it's going to be absolutely beautiful. And as we move into tonight, it's a mostly clear sky, overnight lows dropping to the upper 40s and lower 50s. So maybe sweater weather for tonight. And as we go over the next couple of days, daytime highs will continue to hold steady in the middle to upper 70s, overnight lows in the middle to upper 40s. So we'll have some chilly nights, but some beautiful afternoons. We could see the temperature climb a little bit for our Wednesday and Thursday, maybe getting a little bit closer to the upper 70s compared to the middle 70s, but really not too much significant change in our weather there. And then even as we move into the upcoming weekend, our weather's more or less going to stay steady with overnight lows kind of hovering near 50 degrees, daytime highs lower to middle 70s for your Friday into your Saturday. Maybe by the time we get into Saturday night into Sunday, we'll introduce a small rain chance. But other than that, throughout this work week, we're looking at predominantly dry skies. And with a westerly flow, we could start to see a little bit more smoke working its way back in. But it doesn't look like it's going to be what we saw in previous weeks with those thicker concentrations. But overall, it's going to be daytime highs, lower to middle 70s, with overnight lows, middle to upper 40s, with dry skies throughout the work week.
Sounds good. Thanks, Thomas. Enjoy your day.
Likewise.
September is National Suicide Prevention Month, and mental health experts say it's vital that people know what resources are available to them when they're in times of crisis. Summit County Health Educator Alyssa Mitchell talked with me about how we can get over our fear of talking about the subject with people we're worried about, warning signs we should be mindful of, and the tools that Summit County offers residents of all ages. Before we start talking about Suicide Prevention Month, will you tell us a little bit about your role with the county overall?
Sure. So I work in the Division of Health Promotion and Education. I am our suicide prevention coordinator. I am trained in question, persuade, and refer. I'm a teacher for that here in Summit County.
Question, persuade, refer. Tell us about that, please.
So QPR, question, persuade, refer, is a suicide prevention tool that can help train individuals on how to recognize someone who might be going through a suicidal or mental health crisis, have a conversation with them and refer them to help, whether that's referring them to a counseling office, taking them to the emergency room, whatever the needs are for that person, basically to keep them safe so that they can get through their crisis.
And you work primarily with minors?
So I work with all age groups. I do a lot of work in the schools, with the schools in Summit County, but I've also provided QPR to many work sites and adult groups as well in Summit County.
I see. And so how long have you been in your role?
6.5 years.
So your approaches vary depending on the age of the person or group of people you're working with and other circumstances, I'd imagine?
Yes, correct. So if I were to do a presentation for youth, it would be completely different in the data I use and the tips and resources that I give them versus adults or even work sites like law enforcement or fire departments, which we've also done presentations for.
So this is surely a tough topic to discuss with people. It's historically been something that people have shied away from, believing that to talk about something could make it happen. And subsequent research through the years has shown that the opposite is true, correct?
Correct, yes. Talking about suicide, having conversations will not increase the risk for somebody thinking about or attempting suicide. If anything, it provides relief and an outlet for that person to really express what they're feeling, what's going on, and ask for the help that they're needing.
So within that framework, in honor of September being Suicide Prevention Month, let's talk about how people can broach the subject with anybody they might be worried about.
The first thing people need to do is, first of all, do a gut check. As you're having conversations with people, is what the other individual saying Does that seem right to you, or do you feel like there's something more going on? Usually our guts will clue us into, oh, what they're saying is not normal, how they're behaving is not normal. Perhaps they're feeling more moody or depressed, or as they speak, they sound hopeless, or maybe they've even got, just as you know these individuals, maybe they've got a lot going on in your life and you worry and see their stress levels increasing, their anxiety increasing. And so as we do our gut check and say, do we think everything is okay, we can then find a way to ask about suicide prevention, which actually the Live On campaign has got some great resources on their website to help people figure out the best approach on how to ask that question. Are you thinking of suicide? I've noticed you're struggling. I'm concerned about you. I want to help you. When people are going through suicide crisis, that's what they want to know, is that there's someone out there who cares about them, has noticed them struggling, and is willing to help them.
Okay. In addition to noticing someone's anxiety and stress, are there other warning signs that you would like to highlight that we should watch for?
Yes. Any change in behavior. So for example, somebody who is normally very outgoing, very social, suddenly becomes reclusive and drawn inward. They may have moments where they become suddenly angry and aggressive. People who will give away prized possessions or try and get certain aspects of their life taken care of without an explanation. One thing that we see quite often is somebody looking for long-term care for their pets, or suddenly trying to get their affairs in order, but they don't say why they're doing it, and there's not a clear timeline as to what their goal is. Other warning signs could also include just different situations people are going through. We've had, in the last year especially, people have felt isolated with quarantining and just being sick, not being able to be as social as they used to. There is that feeling and sense of isolation, and if people are struggling with that, they haven't been able to go out, or perhaps there's been a death in the family, especially if it was by suicide, or perhaps someone's lost their job. All of these types of warning signs all add up and can create that feeling of hopelessness in a person, which increases their risk for suicide.
All right. While we're talking about things people should watch for and should say and do, and we'll get into the Live On resources also, are there things people should not do or say?
I think as far as things not to say, most of the time when I do trainings and I talk with people, people get nervous about asking the question. And so they tend to ask leading questions that give the individual an answer they want. So for example, someone might say, you're not thinking of suicide, are you? They're asking the question about suicide, but they're leading to an answer that's comfortable for them, and it's not going to necessarily solve the problem, because the person who is suicidal might not answer that question honestly now. And so as we ask the question, it's important to take a moment ourselves, calm ourselves, take a deep breath, and ask the question about suicide in a non-judgmental, non-leading manner, and just ask questions in a manner of, are you thinking of suicide? Is this how you're feeling? How can I help you? Versus passing judgment or asking these leading questions, which tends to happen when people get nervous.
And it sounds like you want people to be specific. In other words, instead of saying, are you doing okay? You want people to say, you don't seem like you're doing okay, or I'm worried about how you're doing. Are you thinking about suicide? You want people to spell it out.
Yes, the more specific we can be, the better we're able to help somebody. So often I hear people say, well, I've asked the question, are you thinking of hurting yourself? And while you may get an answer, it's not the answer that you're necessarily looking for, because people who are in crisis don't think of themselves as hurting themselves. They're trying to relieve pain. And so it's okay to ask questions like, are you okay? But eventually we need to follow up with those specific questions of, are you thinking of suicide? Because we need to get to the root problem and get the individual to the help that they need.
It seems like maybe sometimes people ask a question in a way that protects the person asking. Like, I'm afraid of a particular answer, so I'm afraid to go deep.
Yes, and it's it's a very natural response. And a lot of it goes back to that stigma and that misconception that talking about suicide will cause somebody to think about it. And we are working hard at the health department and statewide to try and do away with that misconception, that misunderstanding. Talking about suicide is not going to increase someone's likelihood, and it's a conversation that we should be having like any other conversation about our health.
Okay. Why don't we talk a little bit about the resources that Summit County has? Everybody in Utah has these resources, right? Do you want to tell us a little bit about the Live On program?
Yes. So the Live On campaign is a statewide effort to prevent suicide by educating individuals about different resources, connecting people to resources throughout the state, and changing our culture around suicide and mental health. So the goal of the Live On campaign is to provide that resource to individuals to help them reach out and check on somebody that they're concerned about, provide them with the tools to empower individuals, to remind them of their worth. And with that, when you go to the Live On campaign website, there's lots of different resources. You can click get resources for if someone's considering suicide themselves, where can they go to get help? If someone's recently lost somebody to suicide, there's resources that could help families get counseling and resources that they need. We can also provide people resources as to letting them know where suicide prevention trainings are. So upcoming question, persuade, refer trainings, upcoming campaigns or community outreach activities, especially this month around the state, there's a lot of out of the darkness walks to create awareness about suicide. And so people can go online, find those events and attend them. In addition to reading up on how to ask the question about suicide and what to do if you need to help somebody and where to send them to. Some great resources that people have access to here in Summit County is the SafeUT app. It's a great resource for students and actually their parents as well. Students can have access to a chat feature or a calling feature if they themselves are struggling with suicide or they know somebody who is. Parents also have access to that as well. If they want help for their children, they can also access the same resources and ask these live individuals, how can I help my child? Where can I send them to? And there's also a great feature where if an individual knows somebody's going to attempt suicide or has been self-harming, they can refer them and submit a tip, which goes straight to the schools, and the schools can then address it with the student, and it's never traced back to the individual who submitted the tip. It's all under one app. Students can register through their schools, and parents can also register as a parent and through their child's school. All of our schools here in Summit County are registered with the SafeUT app.
That is a lot of information available to people. What is the URL for the Live On program?
It's liveonutah.org.
That's great. So there's the app that is SafeUT, and then there's liveonutah.org. What would you like to say to anybody who might be listening who needs some help right now?
So September is Suicide Prevention Awareness Month. This is a great time if you're needing help, to reach out to one of these resources and start getting help for yourself. We at Summit County, we care about our community and we want to provide resources to everyone who needs it. And if anyone has any questions, they're welcome to call the Summit County Health Department, and we'd be happy to also connect them to any resources.
I think pretty well understood right now about COVID impacts. I was wondering if there are other factors specific to our area that contribute to suicidal tendencies or any mental health crises that you see and that you work with that might be something people would want to know more about or think about.
Well, one thing, and that's a great question, one thing that comes to mind with that is Summit County and Utah in general has high firearm ownership rates, and with that comes risk for individuals who are thinking of suicide. We encourage families, if they have someone in the home who's going through a mental health crisis, to make sure to lock up their firearms and to store the ammunition separate. And actually, local police departments and gun ranges can also store firearms temporarily so that individuals can get through their mental health crisis and start receiving treatment as they need it. Firearm deaths are high, and suicide is the number one cause of firearm deaths in Utah. So here in Summit County, we encourage people to, if you know somebody who is struggling, lock up the firearms or have them stored away from the home temporarily until that individual receives help.
Okay, thank you so much. Thanks for your time, and thanks for the work you're doing.
Thank you. I appreciate being able to call today.
Autumn Aloft is a hot air balloon exhibition that's been happening in Park City off and on since the 80s, an Instagrammable event long before Instagram existed. It's free and it's a visual feast as long as the weather cooperates. I talked to Misha Ross, who's been working with the event since 2014, about its backstory and what's happening this year. So I think there are people in town, of course, who know all about this, who are looking forward to it, but we have a lot of newcomers who have perhaps never seen anything like this. I'm looking forward to explaining it to them, although it's kind of hard to put into words, right?
Yeah, I think so.
How long has Autumn Aloft been going on?
You know, Autumn Aloft is a really interesting backstory. Autumn Aloft started in probably the 80s, and it took place in Park Meadows, and it was well before Park Meadows was as built out as it is today. In about the mid-90s, Autumn Aloft ended because it got too big for the space that it had. And then in the early 2010s, I don't know what we call that, Monty Coates, who owns two stores on Main Street, he gathered a group of people here in town and kind of wanted to ask the question, what does it take to bring a balloon event back to Park City in the fall? Monty thought, and I believe he was right, that it was a really great opportunity to drive additional visitation to what then was a slower period, and also just to give our local community an opportunity to gather for a morning and enjoy a unique, spectacular sight. So the backstory is it started in the 80s. It lasted about 10 years, and then it took about a 20-year hiatus, and in 2014, we brought Autumn Aloft back in its current version.
So how long have you been associated with it?
Since 2014.
Okay. Now, 18 balloons, is that the same number that we usually see?
It is a lower number. We did decrease our number of balloons that we invited to the event just to kind of stick our toe in the water a little bit slowly. You know, we were hopeful that COVID would not be where it is right now with the Delta variant, but we still wanted to just kind of take it slow. When we first brought back Autumn Aloft in 2014, I believe we had 14 balloons. So it sort of inched up slowly, and then just kind of taking a little step back, and are going to go off with 18 balloons this year.
And then what's the highest number you've ever had for one festival?
I think 22 is what we've had fly.
Now, last year was canceled due to the pandemic, and then was it the previous year that the balloons could not launch because of weather? Is that correct?
I think that was the year. There were 2 years that we had a bad weather day and or two. I believe that 2019 was the year that we had really interesting weather where it was just really windy, but higher up even. So down on the ground, we couldn't necessarily feel it as much. What happens and what's really interesting is before the balloons take off at the pilot meeting, they'll fill a balloon with helium and let it go up to kind of see what the winds are doing at different levels of the atmosphere. And so once you see the black balloon, tiny little helium balloon go up, and that's what the pilots are looking for so that they can know what to expect once they get in the air.
It's the proverbial trial balloon.
Exactly. Yeah, they have a name for it. I can't remember it right now. But yeah, they put that up there. And generally, you know, they're concerned that the wind speeds, even anything, you know, above like 10 miles an hour, it makes it where they're uncomfortable flying. So winds are really important. And then, of course, any precipitation has an impact. And that's something that's really important. You know, Autumn Aloft is a weather-driven event. The weather does have to cooperate for us to put the balloons up in the air, and we keep safety as our number one priority. So that if the weather is questionable, our balloon meister, Mike Bowens, who's lived here in Park City for, oh gosh, decades, he makes the final call. And so it's really great for us that he is familiar with Park City weather patterns. And so he kind of knows how to read the weather, how it's behaving in the early morning, and how we can expect it to behave for the rest of the early morning and into mid-morning.
Okay. And because it's weather-driven, that's why the 8 a.m. start time is approximate, of course. You just kind of have to see how it goes. And then let's say the weather gods are smiling and everything goes well and the balloons get up there. How long are they up in the air where people can see them?
You know, that's such a tricky question because it depends on where you are, right? Like, if you are at the field, they may go up, so at the North 40 field, they may go up, and again, like wherever kind of that pilot balloon went, if it kind of drifts off and goes over into the neighborhood, they'll be harder to see if you're on the field. But many times we've had great fortune, and what happens is the balloons will go up, and the weather can be so calm and still that they'll just kind of hover around the field and they'll, you know, land back on the field. So that's really exciting when that happens. And those instances generally from about 8 until 9:30, there's something to see. But in some instances, they'll launch at about 8 o'clock and, you know, by 8:30, the field is looking a little sparse. So it just really depends on what the weather does that day.
Sure. And when the weather is perfect and the balloons are up, it is so spectacular, and you cannot take enough pictures. And I'm guessing that you've had some run-ins with drones of some sort.
So we have not had a run-in with drones, but actually it's because the event is certified by the FAA. So it's a no drone event because of that. The Federal Aviation Agency, they do not allow drones because the airspace is taken up by the balloon.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. I pictured a drone running into a balloon, and I was going to ask you what happens in that situation. So that has not happened.
Yeah, we try to restrict drones before that happens so that we don't have that happen, because I can imagine that there's nothing more frightening. The unfortunate situation with drones is we can't pinpoint where the pilot of the drone is. So we can't manage them, and drones and drone pilots don't necessarily understand flight paths of hot air balloons. So it's just a situation that we don't feel mixes, and the FAA does not think is a good combination. So if you are a drone pilot and you know, you're really looking to get some good drone footage, you just need to stay out of the flight area. So if I were going to fly a drone, I would probably hike up around Park City Mountain Resort or something along those lines and just maintain a very, very, very far distance from where the balloons are. And what we know about balloons is that they, you know, kind of want to stay in what they call the bowl. So that's the flat area of Park City. So we would probably call it a valley, but the balloon pilots call it a bowl. And so they'll stay kind of above the North 40 field and or into the Park Meadows residential area, but they won't go close to any mountains because they can't know what's going to happen with the winds over in those areas. And so they like to stay where they can guarantee what's going to happen with the weather.
So drone operators, go up high and don't get near the bowl. That has me thinking about what could go wrong for a hot air balloon pilot in terms of large birds, or have there ever been any sort of catastrophes or anything wildlife related here?
No. We have been very fortunate. Again, all of the pilots, this is an invite-only event, and the pilots that are invited to fly in Park City are very highly skilled with many, many hours of training under their belt. I think that the pilots who are invited here are very comfortable in wildlife situations and all of the situations. They're also very comfortable navigating their airspace, and they've all been here for many years, so they all kind of know the drill. Generally, during autumn aloft, our leaves are peaking, and it's just such a great time. The weather is perfect. It's a beautiful place to experience not only a balloon event from the ground as a spectator, but also the pilots. Each year, our balloon meisters, you know, have a waiting list, and this year it's even longer than normal because we did decrease the amount of pilots, but it is some of the best pilots from the region.
So it's a specialized skill set, to say the least. Are the pilots...
Yeah, definitely.
Are the pilots the owners of the balloons that they pilot?
I would say 95% of the time that is the case. Oftentimes there may be, you know, one pilot who's flying a balloon for their friend, but generally they are the owners. This is a hobby of theirs. They go to balloon rallies, they call them, all year round. So they, this is kind of what they do in their free time, and they are all very passionate. Another interesting thing is that they do have an actual pilot license, and that's something that's obviously required before you can fly a balloon.
So that's not something that probably most people think about. They just look up and think, wow, they look great. Do you have any idea how much hot air balloons cost? It's a hobby like any other, but a pretty major one. I mean, even storing them, right?
Well, you know, they actually do hold down smaller than you would think. You know, we're used to seeing the commercial balloons flying in our skies, and generally those balloons are even bigger than the balloons that we have at Autumn Aloft, and they hold, I don't know how many passengers, but quite a few. Our pilots that we have fly in Autumn Aloft, they fly what we call sport balloons. And the sport balloons generally only hold two passengers and the pilot. So this is a completely different experience than what you can pay for from commercial balloon pilot. Autumn Aloft does not sell balloon rides, but people, sponsors who help put on the event, one of their sponsor benefits is a balloon ride. So it's one of those things that is a really special opportunity and a great way to, you know, get involved with hot air ballooning is to start as a sponsor of a hot air balloon event.
Okay, so that's something that is in place already. It's not as though anybody can come to what is really more of an exhibition and say, I want to sponsor you. Can I please go for a ride now?
No, if they're interested and they hear this, there are still opportunities to sponsor what we call a balloon sponsor. And that really is, you know, that financial contribution, I think it's $1,500. That $1,500 contribution truly pays for that pilot to come here. Autumn Aloft, you know, brings these pilots in. We pay them a fee to fly their balloons, and then we also pay for their lodging over the weekend, and then we also pay for their propane over the weekend. So each balloon, you know, has a significant cost associated with it. So that's where those balloon sponsorships come in, is that they really help to help the balloons get off the ground.
All right, good to know. So if somebody is thinking, I would like to sponsor a balloon, should they go to autumnaloft.com, or is there another way that they should contact you?
Yeah, they should definitely go to autumnaloft.com, and there is a form they can fill out if they're interested in a sponsorship of a balloon. You know, what we hear in other markets that I think is really cool is that the same pilot will have the same sponsor year after year after year, and they just truly become really great friends. I've heard stories of sponsors traveling to other balloon events and even other countries to be a part of them with their pilots. So it's kind of a really unique and special way to kind of become involved in the sport.
It's a good way to leave the earth without getting on a plane.
It's a great way. You know, and what's so cool, I went on a hot air balloon in Turkey probably 10 years ago, and it was the craziest experience of my life because there were probably 32 people in the balloon, and everyone spoke a different language, and it was just, it was not very relaxing.
Well, I'm hoping the weather cooperates for you. Do you want to talk a little bit about the Candlestick on Main event?
Yeah, so the Candlestick on Main event is a really fun way to kind of get under the hood, I like to say, hey, of a hot air balloon. This year we will have 8 baskets and their burners. So we don't have the big envelope that what you see kind of inflating and lifting up the balloon. So you really can kind of see how the fire and the hot air, how powerful it is, and kind of start to understand how that powerful air elevates the balloon. The 8 baskets and their burners, they basically, we have a DJ, and the burners kind of perform to the beats from the music. So it kind of feels like you're in a choreographed experience. We allow spectators to pull the burner so they, again, can kind of understand how it all really works underneath that that balloon envelope. And then it's on Main Street between 4th and 5th Street. It is free. Everyone is welcome to come. We are encouraging, you know, visitors to wear masks, although Autumn Aloft is outdoors and does provide ample space for social distancing. We do still feel that if you would prefer to wear a mask, we definitely support that, and definitely are grateful that our event allows for space and does not have the need to, you know, get up close and personal.
All right, that all sounds great. Thank you for the information. I wish everybody a sunny, clear, just the right amount of wind kind of weekend for the event.
Thank you so much. We do too.
After a lengthy discussion, the Summit County Council last Wednesday adopted a new policy on accessory buildings. The vote was split 3-2. Rick Bruff reports the council's vote came just a couple of days before the county's temporary moratorium on new applications for side buildings was due to expire.
The county council looked at four options and in the end voted for a set of guidelines recommended by the Snyderville Planning Commission. Voting in favor were council members Roger Armstrong, Doug Clyde, and Glenn Wright. Voting against were council members Chris Robinson and Melina Stevens. Accessory buildings have attracted controversy in areas like Lower Silver Creek and Old Ranch Road because of criticisms that owners are putting up too many small buildings or are constructing big arena-like structures. 6 months ago, the council enacted a temporary zoning moratorium, which expires Friday, September 10th. Council member Doug Clyde told KBCW this was one of those health, safety, and welfare issues where government had to act.
Are you better off if your neighbor is allowed to build a huge industrial like looking building next to you, or are you better off if you restrict that use? And I think there is growing concern that those uses are partially out of control, and most importantly that we could end up with a plethora of those uses, and they could get grandfathered in. It would be impossible for us to change if we don't put some controls on it now.
Snyderville Commission recommended three classes of structures. A minor accessory building can be allowed up to 2,000 square feet, with a smaller shed up to 400 square feet. A major accessory building would be allowed to a maximum of 12,500 square feet. Only one would be permitted per lot and would not be allowed on a lot less than an acre. And finally, shipping containers would be prohibited in all zones. Council member Chris Robinson opposed the restrictions, especially a height limit of 26 feet. He also said the limits were a one-size-fits-all formula that would allow little development on a large piece of property. Robinson favored using a percentage or metric to apply to all properties, but staff planner Ray Milliner said they couldn't find a formula that worked for everybody's parcel. Council member Roger Armstrong said he can support structures built for toys or equipment or equestrian uses, up to a point, but he said more and more is getting built in the basin.
If we want rooftops, we're getting them in spades. You know, the entrance to Old Ranch Road now looks entirely different than it did 10 years ago. It's no longer something I would consider rural residential. It's looking a lot more like Bel Air, California. It's just a collection of very large houses clustered together. When you start getting into some of the ranch properties, and even those are acquiring more buildings on those lots, go ahead and allow more rooftops, more accessory buildings, larger accessory buildings, a lot more indoor riding arenas and sport courts and car storage places and toy barns and on and on and on.
Meanwhile, Robinson told Armstrong he's trying to ensure a flexibility for property owners.
You talk as though I'm asking for unfettered property rights. I'm asking for a small percentage. I'm asking for a single-digit percentage to allow flexibility to use property. There are people that want to own these parcels that would like to do something with them. They're not agriculturalists. To be able to use a single-digit percentage of that land. And nowhere have you heard me say, I want 5 or 10 big buildings. I said, I'm willing to limit it to 3 accessory buildings.
Council member Melina Stevens told KPCW she voted against the Planning Commission option because it doesn't do enough to balance the interests of individual property owners with the overall community. She added that during public input, some concerned residents thought the option was too restrictive to allow for equestrian uses. Stevens said the guidelines didn't include changes responding to public input. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
The Friends of the Summit County Search and Rescue presented a budget request to the Summit County Council at its meeting last week. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more on what the search and rescue is asking for and how much it might cost.
Search and rescue is a reality of everyday life in the Wasatch Back. Summit County Search and Rescue responded to 16 emergency calls last month. Crews helped in everything from lost hikers in the Uintas to separated parties right here in the Park City area. Summit County Search and Rescue is made up of 38 volunteers who perform over 90 missions per year across nearly 1,900 square miles of terrain. At Wednesday's Summit County Council meeting, Friends of Summit County Search and Rescue presented a proposal asking to upgrade some aging equipment and refresh the department's radios. Altogether, the search and rescue wish list includes roughly $275,000 in equipment, including an ask for 2 six-wheel vehicles that will help crews access remote areas quickly, and a snowcat with a price tag of $150,000. Friends of Summit County Search and Rescue's Candace Hart told the council the specialized radios used by rescue crews need replacing soon, whether the county wants this or not, thanks to a statewide upgrade to the system the 800 megahertz radios operate on.
It's funny when you think of that radio. One radio costs $1,700, and that's actually a pretty good discount. If we tried to buy this as a civilian, they're really expensive, these 800 megahertz radios. But that's what the county needs. That's what operates on the system. The entire operating system for all the radios is changing, I think, in about a year. So all the old radios are just going to become bricks. So, and that's everybody in the state. So everybody's having to upgrade.
Summit County began its yearly budgeting process in June before a recommended budget is presented to the County Council on October 13th. Councilor Doug Clyde told KPCW there is a formal process all requests must go through before money can be allocated towards a particular department.
The budgeting process is coming up. Certainly among our priorities would be to properly fund these people. As usual, their requests will get aggregated with every other department. So remains to be seen, but obviously we're very supportive of search and rescue.
Summit County passed a $57.4 million 2021 budget last December. After the recommended 2022 budget is presented, informational sessions will take place through November 1st before public hearings begin at the start of December. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
In other news, yesterday afternoon, two people went to the hospital for non-life-threatening injuries after a crash in Echo Canyon on Interstate 80. They were driving westbound around 1 o'clock when their car flipped near mile marker 170. No other cars were involved, and Utah Highway Patrol didn't report a cause or details about the victims. Utah Highway Patrol, Park City, and North Summit Fire, and a Summit County Sheriff's deputy responded. Both patients went to the University of Utah Hospital, one by helicopter. Most recent reports as of yesterday afternoon said the victim's injuries were not life-threatening. In other headlines, a Park City nonprofit signed a deal to conserve a Midway Hot Springs property. KPCW's Ben Lassiter has more.
At the request of Midway City and with broad support in other local governments, the Summit Land Conservancy purchased 40 acres of the Mountain Spa property in Midway. The 40 acres makes up about half of Mountain Spa's 78 total acres. They're situated adjacent to River Road and Bergie Lane. Cheryl Fox is the executive director of the Summit Land Conservancy. She says the main motivation is to keep an important part of Midway the way people there like it.
We heard from community members there in Midway that these are really important to the feel, the rural community, as people come into town, as people come home to Midway.
The Conservancy's website says it will minimize and cluster development and restore a boutique resort there. It'll also create 4 home sites. A developer got approval to build on the site in 2007, but has since agreed to cut their plans in half from the original agreement. Fox says Midway residents support the resort plans because they'll bring in sales tax revenue. The hot springs there will still be available to the public, but within the resort, so not free to access. The resort area's future has been a frequent topic at Midway City Council and Wasatch County Council meetings recently. Fox signed the papers to make it official Tuesday.
We're able to reduce the density, you know, by massive amounts on the property. So this is pretty exciting. We started looking at a bunch of different options and ways to preserve this property. It has a lot of challenges. You know, it is within the Midway city limits, so it had incredibly high density, which made it very expensive.
Fox says the nonprofit used $1.8 million in open space funding from the city and county, and it's partnering with other agencies as well.
We were really fortunate. We found some great partners, including the Midway Open Space Committee and Midway City Council. They were funded through a bond that was passed in 2018. And then also Wasatch County and the Wasatch Open Land Board also wanted to see the green pasture protected.
Going forward, some buildings Fox described as derelict will be taken down or renovated. Aside from the hot pots or springs, the open space the Conservancy preserved will include geological craters, wetlands, and areas important to winter wildlife. To learn more about the Summit Land Conservancy, visit wesaveland.org. Ben Lasseter, KPCW News.
The Park City Educational Foundation supports the Park City Public School District to the tune of about $2 million a year, which funds programs such as dual language immersion, pre-kindergarten programs, and robotics, among a host of others. Park City Ed Foundation Executive Director Abby McNulty joins us on the phone this morning with an update on the foundation's work and a reminder that some of us are going to be getting the call pretty soon. Good morning, Abby. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So Beat the Call is back. When we first moved here, I did not know what that was. I do now. Would you give everybody a lowdown on it, please?
Sure. So Beat the Call is a campaign we do every fall to ask parents to make a contribution in support of the work that Park City Education Foundation does to support all schools and students in Park City School District. We ask parents to give a donation of $1 for each day their child's in a classroom. So for one student, that's $180 a year, or two students, $360. And the Beat the Call campaign is a pretty big effort over the next 2 weeks. It starts today. Envelopes go home at the elementary schools, for example, and you can put in your donation in that envelope and send it back to school with your kids, or you can go online and make a contribution at pcf4kids.org. And the goal is to raise money to support the programs that PCF funds in Park City School District. And if we don't hear from you in the next 2 weeks, we have a really wonderful group of high school students who get together and start making phone calls to parents in our community to say, hey, don't forget about us. This is a great organization to support, and it supports, we support over 100 programs in our schools and reach all 5,000 students.
So those calls are going to be hard to resist.
Yeah. Yes.
So how significant a portion of your annual fundraising is Beat the Call?
Well, really, when Beat the Call started many, many years ago, it was a huge portion of the organization's budget each year. But we've grown pretty considerably. We have large activities, like many people know, Running with Ed and Red Apple Gala. We also have a leadership annual giving program called Scholar Circle. So at this point, it's a huge, really important piece of the budget. It's not as big as it used to be, but what is most critical about Beat the Call is getting parents off the sidelines and making investments in our public schools. And so we really track not the dollars, but the participation. And so we look for 50% participation from all parents, and we really drive that during Beat the Call.
Sure. So Red Apple Gala is historically your biggest fundraiser. It was canceled last year due to the pandemic.
Apparently,
it's come roaring back this year. I just found out that it sold out before I could get tickets. I've never been. Will you tell us a little bit about what that's going to look like this year and give everybody a teaser who doesn't have a ticket?
Sure. The Red Apple Gala is it's a large formal gala event. It's hosted by Montage Deer Valley, and it is on October 2nd. We did have to cancel last year, and as you said, that was a big hit to our budget. So we're very excited to be able to host it this year. It sold out in 2 days in July. It's a really fun, well-loved event, and we raise about $500,000 each year from the Red Apple Gala.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
What's the goal this year for fundraising? Is that the goal?
That is the goal this year, yes. So we look to our sponsors and our table buyers and our ticket buyers and all the amazing guests who raise the paddle to support the organization, its programs, and buy live and silent auction items to reach that goal.
Okay. So you said something when we spoke a while back that I think, encapsulates the work that the Education Foundation does. You said people are moving here from areas with strong government funding of public schools, and they likely expect the same excellence here that they had wherever they came from. But Utah's education spending and its method of distributing funds means that without the efforts of foundations like yours, it would probably be an impossibility to achieve that same level of excellence. Do you want to talk a little bit about Utah education funding?
Sure. So, like you mentioned, a lot of new families are not familiar with how the education funding works here, and it's pretty eye-opening. So Utah is the lowest educational funding, has the lowest funding for public education per student in the country. And 96% of the tax dollars allocated towards education in Summit County, which are redistributed throughout the rest of the state to help fully fund other school districts who do not have the same tax base that we do here in Park City. So imagine all of the school districts in the state, in the southern half of the state, that are largely public land. So 96% of our tax dollars collected for education leave the community to fund other school districts. We do have local property tax, local levy, that funds our education system here in Park City. But the pandemic has really made clear our schools and teachers are essential for successful families, successful business, and a successful community. And that takes more investment than our state provides. And so that's what's really important. That's why the Education Foundation is really important. Every dollar given to the Park City Education Foundation stays here in our community and is invested into our schools through a series of grant programs. And we distribute at minimum $1.3 million back into our schools each year.
And what that looks like is so varied because there are so many different programs that the Ed Foundation funds. I mentioned a few at the beginning. Is there a program you want to talk about right now? I think we talked about discussing the elementary visual arts program as one example among many.
Yes, exactly. So elementary visual arts program, we also call it EVA for short, is a perfect example of why the Education Foundation matters in our community. Many years ago, visual art education was wiped out of the school district's budget, was wiped out of the state budget. And so the fact that our kids have art in our elementary schools is because of the work of the Park City Education Foundation. So EVA is a partnership with the Kimball Art Center. And every month or more, kids at Trailside, McPolin, and Parley's have amazing art lessons and activities taught by trained art educators. And they get to explore amazing artists. They learn the history of the artist. They learn the context in which the artist worked in their time, and then they make a project inspired by that artist's work, and they get to use amazing materials. They get wonderful experience learning how to be creative, pushing visual arts to its limits in a way. So creativity is so important. Art is so important for kids. It helps kids problem solve. It helps kids build their confidence when perhaps, you know, the mainstream classroom isn't always a place for them to be successful. I have a dyslexic daughter. So in her early years, it was really hard and a struggle. She always found confidence and her groove in the art class because that is where she could always be successful. So elementary visual arts, also known as EVA, is the perfect example of one of the programs that the Ed Foundation brings to Park City School District.
That just sounds great. Lucky kids. So fun.
Lucky kids, yeah.
For sure. Thanks, Abby. So is there anything else we didn't touch on that you wanted to mention this morning?
If people want to learn more about the Park City Education Foundation and the programs that we support, we have an outstanding website, PCEF4kids.org, and that's a great place to find information on our programs and all upcoming activities.
Okay, excellent. Thanks again. Have a good day. Good to talk.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.